Welcome to the Booktopia podcast. I'm John Purcell, and I'm here with Julia Bard to talk about her new book, Victoria, the Queen. Welcome, Julia.
Thank you for having me.
Now, this is a big, whopping history book, a perfect read for Christmas when you've got a bit of time off. These kind of books, in-depth, large, chunky and sort of get your teeth into kind of books, they always strike me as taking like a decade to put together. How long did it take to you to get this kind of thing together? It looks like there's a lot of work's gone into it.
There has been a lot of work. I mean, to write the history of Victoria, you're also writing the history of a century, you know, and not just England. She was involved in the breakup of the Ottoman Empire. There was what was happening in South Africa, China, like the Australia. Yeah, so getting all of that right and actually getting access to all the materials was very time consuming as well. But I guess about 6 years. Yeah.
And is this something that came because you were already reading, like, in the history of 19th century, or is it come from an interest in women in power?
Yeah.
So it's women in power in the 19th century.
Yeah, it was when I was in the States. I'd written a PhD about women and power and the way we think of them, and it's something I've thought of a lot. And when I was in the States working at Newsweek, and it was the 2008 presidential election, so we were dealing with Hillary Clinton and Sarah Palin, and we were just having all these really intense debates around the editorial table about the way we think about women wanting or exercising power. And my editor was a historian who'd written a biography of Andrew Jackson, and he was always saying to me, we were just always talking about history. And one day he said, you know, you really should look at Queen Victoria. I don't think she's been examined properly for a while. And that's actually how it happened. So it's the most bizarre coincidence that now, you know, that this week Hillary Clinton may or may not become the President of the United States.
Well, if she doesn't become the President of the United States, you probably won't be hearing this because the world has ended.
You're not the only person to have said that.
So dealing with Victoria, there's a view of Victoria out there in the world already. We all know who this woman is. We all know that she's the grandmother of Europe, that she had a fling with Billy Connolly. there's certain things that we know that Albert died, a lot of those actually are about her as a woman and not in a really positive sense.
Yep.
So you had to dig beyond that and the way in which she would have been reported even in people's letters and journals and by men, casting her aside in certain, or casting her as something.
Yes.
How did you go about finding the real Victoria?
Well, you have to read as much as you can of her actual words, those that are remaining, her journals, her letters, her diaries. And sometimes just even examining that material afresh, you can see how many assumptions were built into it. You know, assumptions about... and by the way, the official editors of her letters, Benson and Escher, heavily favoured the letters from her prime ministers instead of even hers in return, and cut out a lot of her correspondence with other women and anything that they considered trivial, so be about, you know, relationships or about children. And I think that is really, really telling, as well as various prejudices she had about the French and the Irish and so on. So to try to make her more palatable. They disinfected her, I think. So you have to go back to the originals of all of those documents. But to me, the myths really were that she wasn't that interested in power, that she kind of had only ever ruled with Albert, and that, you know, he was obviously the far superior ruler, that he was basically the king, that when he died, she didn't do very much. She was just kind of in mourning, and she was a very severe, unamused creature in mourning, instead of someone who, in that period, for 40 years, ruled on her own. It was someone who was heavily involved in politics, who did not like being in the public eye so much, to an extent I thought it was some kind of agoraphobia, like a real anxiety about being stared at. And can you imagine if you're queen, how that would be exacerbated? And someone who had, you know, who fell in love again, who really did love her Scottish Highland servant, I think very deeply, and who, but with both delighted and infuriated prime ministers in turn. So I really wanted to examine who this woman was. Also, another myth, by the way, was that she was a mother who hated children. That there was recently a documentary on the BBC in several parts claiming exactly that. I was amazed when I saw it that they hadn't actually looked at the diaries from when she'd first had her children, the first part of her life. She was harsh. She was a disciplinarian. She thought that infants were frog-like, but as anyone who's had children knows, they are like little frogs. Well, you know the Morrow reflex when they go, kind of splay their limbs. Sorry, I just almost demonstrated that to you, didn't I? I think we also said things about her as a mother and a queen that we wouldn't have said about a father as a king.
No, you don't. You don't even mention
it. Like, no, who says that?
No, you don't.
Let alone the fact that everyone's like, oh, you're working on Victoria. Gosh, she was so fat. I'm like, really? Is that the first thing you say to when someone's writing about Henry VIII, George IV? You know what I mean? There's a long association of corpulence with the royal family through that period in history. And people, it's incredible the stereotyping we can do for a woman who was, you know, one of the most powerful we've known.
Yeah, when the stuttering king, I only knew about it being a stuttering king once they made the movie about him being a stuttering king.
Yeah.
They didn't mention it before that.
Yeah.
I mean, that's something to mention. And yet, they go,
isn't that interesting?
Yeah, they go quite happily to talk about the appearance, that she wore black, that she was large, all those sort of...
But Bernard Shaw wrote about this as well. I can't remember when it was. It was in the early 1900s, and they had a competition to find the ugliest statue in England. And he wrote this thing about, oh, poor Victoria. He said, you know, she had this ease of movement. She had this silvery voice. She walked very lightly. A lot of observers said she had a real grace and elegance to it. She said, but by looking at her statues, everyone in her dominion would think she was a huge heap of a woman, you know.
Yeah.
And again, that's what people focus on. It's kind of unfortunate that people snap froze her in such a severe and unappealing stance.
Have you contracted a... One of those social diseases. Now that you've spent so much time in the 19th century, that you are going to start quoting Shaw and people like that as part of your just natural conversation.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, you're going to get ostracised.
George Bernard said. I know. I feel like I have kind of outed myself as a massive nerd through all of this, but now that it's finally out, and you can see how I've obsessed over archives and little historical details for so long. But when I was doing the drum, when I was researching this, quite often we'd be in the middle of a discussion about politics. I'd be like, yeah, well, for example, Gladstone did that. And my producer would always laugh in my ear. And I'm like, well, it's relevant, right? People want to know about Disraeli when they're talking about Tony Abbott. Actually, that's not the right comparison, probably.
No.
But nonetheless, yes.
No, more Turnbull, I think.
maybe. Who's Gladstone? We need a Gladstone.
We do need it. This world needs a Gladstone.
This world, yes.
Yeah.
The great man.
Yeah. So, Victoria comes in contact with these members of history, these big monoliths of history as well. And during that period, when you said you're researching, she's becomes the global empire. But things like evolution is there. You've got a very varied kind of kingdom as well, because you've got the sense of propriety and all that sort of stuff, but then you've got Becky Sharp from Vanity Fair in people's imaginations. You've got there's just so many different ways to look at the 19th century.
Mm.
There's the Dickens version of the 19th century, and there's the George Eliot version. There's within the same period, you've got these different versions, and then you've got this clash of cultures in India. Mm. So that to me seems like a massive amount of work. How did you manage all this information? In the process of actually writing, did you have a massive wall with a plan? Or like that kind of thing just boggles my mind.
No, probably the person who was as organised as writing a massive wall with a plan wouldn't necessarily write a biography, although I'm sure they exist. people with card boxes in the old school, like Antonia Fraser used to do. No, I just wrote copious notes. And honestly, it's just like you're inhabiting another world. It's like Claire Tomlin, when she wrote her biography of Dickens, said she used to just shut her study door and then descend into the mud. That walking into, and that's the real delight of it. I actually think it's a real mindfulness, that incredible absorption in something else. To me, a real challenge was, I mean, you are trying to understand the tectonic plates, like what's happening around the world in terms of physical geography, imperialism, breaking up of empire, imposition of empire, what happened in Ireland, as well as what was happening in thought, in terms of challenge and religious doubt and suffrage and women and so on. So fascinating. There was so much ferment. To me, its real challenge was actually getting a scene right.
Yeah.
And it's almost what I loved. And I've had a couple of people say, oh, it's amazing how you fictionalize the beginning of chapters. And when you say, I'm like, oh no, there is nothing fictional. Like the extent I'd go to, like to work out what the weather was, when the clouds would have moved across the sun. If I say the flag was up, I'll have to find out, was the wind moving? Was it blowing that day? But someone said, well, wait, but you said she was lying in her bed, which was, I don't know, made of whatever, and which was painted white, and she could hear carts rolling down the street, and people were baking bread. I'm like, yes, because I got the accounts of the carts rolling down the street. And what's so great is the newspaper accounts at the time were fantastic. There was no TV.
Mm-hmm.
And there were these brilliant writers that you'd go back to look at the coronation and key moments in her life, and there'd be Dickens and there'd be Trollope. Felix Mendelssohn is poking his head over in the crowds and writing about it. So you had this incredibly vivid descriptions. You would literally have a writer on each corner of kind of like Hyde Park to talk to you about it all. So that was the trickiest thing, is the accuracy of all of that. But it's to work out which flowers were blooming when she was born, and would she have smelt a floor up? Well, I said I was a nerd, right? Yeah. So it's like, but it's also completely fascinating.
So you hang out with Hilary Mantel now.
Right.
It's the same sort of, I mean, for people who write historical fiction who are obsessed with getting
the details right.
That right. Yeah. You've gone to the same madhouse.
Yeah, you know, gone to the same. Yeah, but getting it exacting and realising, I remember one time saying I wrote about that there was a heavy thud of a boot, and I'm like, would that boot have been a clap? Would that boot have been a thud? What was the boot made of? And was it on cobblestones?
You went straight onto Google and started looking.
Trying to find. Oh, no, you just kind of, yeah. And looking, then you tried to find images of the actual boots and what would the road have been like. And that's a little bit nuts. But I could never have taken liberties with that kind of stuff as well.
Okay, so we're talking about a woman who's been born into power, not in the right line, but she got power because of who she was rather than what she did.
Yep.
If she was up there running for power today, is it someone that you would be getting behind? Is she someone that you think should be in that role? Is it something that you think in her character that actually suited very well this? Because it is a strange role for even now, the Queen.
Very strange.
Because there is a parliament underneath, but you do have these strings you can pull, and there are things you can do and you can't do. Is she someone that would fit the role? Like, if you saw her campaigning, would you be backing Victoria?
Look, the demands of political life are obviously very different now to the way they were. Although, mind you, she had incredible stamina. Like, she really had, you know, 9 children with barely blinking, and was very, very robust. Look, I think that what's interesting about watching someone with inherited power, and this was often the case with women before they were allowed to do anything else, is you can actually see what a woman could do in that role of decent capabilities. And it actually reminded me a bit of Catherine Graham, Kay Graham, when she took over the Washington Post, and she writes that whole thing about doubting her own power, you know, doubting her own abilities and taking over a family business. But she'd someone who was steeped in it, was obsessed with it, and ended up being brilliant at what she did. Victoria was incredibly hardworking, incredibly determined and decisive. She's the one that said she was the not for turning original, you know, before Margaret Thatcher came along. She was not bowed by you know, powerful men around her. She would have had her weaknesses, as leaders have, strangely mm-hmm. enough, as we've observed often in current times of... she wasn't... I think we look back in history and go, oh, Gladstone was so visionary. Look what he was trying to do with Ireland. Look at the reform he was introducing. She was much more of her times, reflecting the view of her subjects. After she saw what happened in the Crimean War, very loath to get more involved in another war in Europe. She was someone who, when confronted with... Like, she really loved Dickens, but when confronted with the sight of poverty, because she was so often protected from it, mm-hmm. was concerned about it, but she wasn't, again, the reformer that Albert was. I mean, he would have been an excellent politician in his own right, but he didn't have her stamina.
Yeah.
And her capacity for endurance. So I guess you'd kind of weigh so many things into that. But she certainly supported Disraeli in a lot of his reforms. And I think what I liked about her is that she also, apart from the fact she had no affectation and did not have her head turned by, she wasn't interested in the aristocracy, she didn't need to go to those parties or be part of that society. She yearned for a simple existence. And I think for anyone in public life, that's actually a really good characteristic to have. But I also really admired that she was ahead of her time when it came to, for example, being dictated to by bishops. She would weigh out what they thought, what she agreed with, what she didn't, but she always favoured tolerance. She would write to people in the field in India and say, we recognise other religions, obviously after times of, you know, gross violations of them. She lobbied her ministers and chastised the members of her own household when they were demonstrated prejudice towards her favoured Indian servant, the Munshi, Abdul Karim. So, and I think those signs are good. In a lot of ways, she represented the views of her subjects, and which again is a Howard-esque kind of attribute for a politician, I think. But she also really did have a strong, you know, leaning to an openness.
And do you think that, there's probably still more to be done. I mean, I remember you talking about the how strict the royal family is on the information about their own.
Yeah.
And I was amazed to find that they still own like copyright and things like that over mm-hmm. over things that are 100 years old.
Mm-hmm.
Those kind of difficulties, do you feel that you've been able to push and stretch as much as you can to get to the heart of Victoria, or would you want to, if they suddenly flung the doors open, would there be you rushing in to see what else you could find, or I've done my Victoria research, I'm done?
Oh no, I don't think if there was new material, I would absolutely try to go and see if that let me in to see it, without a doubt. I mean, I think we have indications of what has been destroyed. That's the question, is would we be able to see what's there?
Right.
And the problem with the Royal Archives, there's no catalogue, there's no index.
Right.
So you don't know if they've only given you two of three things or five of eight. So you have to say, was there any correspondence?
Is there no archive for the public or an index for the public, or is there just no?
This doesn't exist.
Doesn't, okay. So no one's actually done it on
it
purpose.
It just doesn't, right. And some are just closed.
Yeah. And there's no, is there any record of people burning stuff? Like are they said on this date so-and-so burnt these papers and that's that? We're done?
Oh, we know when the great acts of historical censorship and destruction have occurred. We know that almost all of Victoria's diaries were burnt, but her daughter rewrote them in her own hand. But we have some of the originals, so we know what her daughter was trying to do, and that was she was trying to make her calmer, less emotional, took out criticisms of the children, anything that would have offended the current king. And anything she's ever done to do with John Brown.
Right, all gone.
She tried to write a memoir about John Brown. Can you imagine how scandalous that would have been at the time? Everyone advised her very firmly against it, and, you know, in terms such as, look, we know what you mean, and of course it would be wonderful, but people might perhaps, because they're so foolish, get the wrong idea from this. So there was a memoir of him, his own journals, all of their correspondence. There was her son, Edward VII, was blackmailed with 300 letters that Victoria had written to the manager of her estate in Balmoral. Her doctor said they were very compromising, they were most compromising, and they were all burnt. We know that anything that was remaining when, as soon as Victoria died, Bertie became king, and it's a history of bonfires.
Oh, jeez.
That's why these little gleanings you can get, any new material that you can get, and that's why I was like so beside myself when I found this new material in Scotland, is so instructive and important. And it is important to know what they don't want you to write,
because
then you know what they're trying to hide.
Their actions tell you something. Yeah, there's nothing. Julie, it's been a great pleasure talking to you. This is just the tip of the iceberg. There's so much more in the book to go into, and it is, as I said in the intro, it really is a book to take on holiday, to give yourself some time to really get into it. And I can imagine people holding this aloft on the beach.
yeah, a little bit sand stained.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming in and talking to us.
Great pleasure. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening to the Booktopia podcast. And don't forget to subscribe to us on SoundCloud and iTunes. And if your eyeballs need a workout, check us out on YouTube at Booktopia TV. And don't forget, for all books featured on this episode and all episodes of the Booktopia podcast, head to Booktopia, Australia's local bookstore, at www.booktopia.com.au. Thanks for listening.